Thanks, everybody. Well, bonsoir, good evening, everyone. Welcome back, and Happy New Year. In my capacity as co-organizer of our Formation Continue series, Think Ahead, Pensez d'Avance, I'm delighted to welcome you to the third session in our series for this academic year. For those of you who were here, I hope you'll concur that we had two wonderful lectures last term on health law and criminal law, and tonight you are in store for an equally interesting evening on issues dealing with procedural abuse, a well-known provision of the Code of Civil Procedure, Article 54.1, and a glimpse into what the future holds in this area of the law with the draft bill outlining essentially a new Code of Civil Procedure, which will be discussed tonight in the particular area of ADR. Je suis absolument ravie de souhaiter la bienvenue à ceux et celles d'entre vous qui nous joignent à l'autre côté du corridor. Puisque la grève est maintenant et enfin terminée, nous pouvons offrir les formations continues avec le live feed et nous sommes très contentes de pouvoir accueillir tout le monde qui veut suivre nos cours. Before we begin with the formal part of our evening, just a few housekeeping and administrative announcements. As usual, you're used to hearing this already. Please turn off everything that rings, dings, buzzes, makes noise. As usual, there will be a break this evening, a 15-minute break, but unlike our other sessions where we've usually taken a break after the first speaker and then had two speakers, this break will be after the second speaker, so it'll be a little later on in the evening, closer to about 7:30. During the break, of course, there are washrooms at your disposal, which are located downstairs in the basement, and there's water for you. There's also some snacks at our table manned by our students in the atrium. The food is, as usual, not for sale, but rather the students would appreciate donations for what you take. And note that all proceeds will go to support the student group offering the food this evening, and that group is the Student Animal Legal Defense Fund, and in particular, funds received from tonight's event will go to finance field trips to an animal refuge and an animal shelter, to fund a municipal bylaw project dealing with animal control laws, and to bring a lawyer from British Columbia who works in animal law to McGill to give a talk on her field. So eat up and donate generously. And as we began to do last year, you will receive an email shortly after this evening's formation with your attestation certificates. For that, of course, you will have needed to register in the atrium. Make sure you do so during the break if you haven't done so beforehand. And finally, the PowerPoints that will be aired this evening will be posted on the Formation Continue website on the Faculty of Law site tomorrow. That's it for my administrative announcements. Now, for those of you who have been here before, you know that our custom is to begin our evening with some words from a distinguished member of the legal community who we invite to act as président d'honneur. This has become a very special feature of our series, and it has enabled us to welcome to our faculty, and often welcome back to our faculty, a wide variety of interesting people, great jurists, and friends. Tonight is, again, no exception. Our most distinguished honorary president is the Honorable Yves-Marie Morissette, a Justice of the Court of Appeal of Quebec. Diplômé de l'Université de Québec à Montréal, où il a obtenu son baccalauréat spécialisé en sciences politiques, ainsi que l'Université de Montréal, où il a complété sa formation en droit avec distinction, il était le récipiendaire de bourses prestigieuses Rhodes, qui l'amenait à Oxford, où il a obtenu son doctorat, sa thèse portant sur le droit comparé de la preuve. Justice Morissette is, of course, no stranger to this faculty. He joined the teaching staff in December of 1977, where he proceeded to have an illustrious career as a professor, researcher, and, of course, dean of the faculty from 1989 to 1994. I served the faculty as an associate dean during that period, and I still have only the most pleasant of memories of our collaboration during his deanship. I also still remember the day in November of 2002 when we all assembled here in the Moot Court to applaud Professor Morissette during his last class, as he was then off to the Quebec Court of Appeal, where he has most ably served as the Honorable Mr. Justice Morissette ever since. Without doubt, this nomination directly to the Court of Appeal was most appropriate in Justice Morissette's case, for he is incredibly cerebral, a true philosopher of law, and an eminent jurist. We are indeed fortunate that this year he is spending his judicial sabbatical here with us at the faculty in my old office that he's babysitting, I might mention. And we are very lucky that he has agreed to serve as our président d'honneur. Of course, Justice Morissette has a particular interest in the topic of tonight's formation continue. Non seulement est le sujet de l'abus processoral un sujet fort important pour tous les juges, mais dans le cas du juge Morissette, c'est un sujet qui l'a intéressé depuis longtemps, et en particulier en 2004, il a publié un article intitulé « Abus de droit, querellance et partie non représentée » dans la revue de droit de McGill. Yves-Marie, merci encore une fois d'avoir accepté notre invitation ce soir, et je t'invite maintenant de prendre la parole.
Thank you very much, Rosalie. That's very generous. A bit off topic. You hadn't warned me, but too generous. Good evening, and welcome back for many of you to McGill. The general theme tonight is really change in the law of civil procedure. When I started to teach civil procedure here in this faculty in 1979, I offer this as a first illustration of change. There wasn't much you could do to prevent or preempt a malicious or a vindictive or a clearly spurious action or litigation. You could use Article 165, but as my former colleague Bachin pointed out to me earlier this week, it was really not comparable to the practice of motions for summary judgment in virtually all the common law jurisdictions around Quebec. And that was about it. You could sue for abuse of right and collect damages, but that wasn't very realistic. I once, in my earlier career, read lots of judgments involving that kind of process, and it could not be said to be effective. You could also use a very small set of judge-made devices, such as orders of costs made against lawyers personally. But that was it. It was the situation in 1979, but the landscape was about to change, and to change radically. The first change, which happened in 85, as I recall, was Article 75.1 of the Code of Civil Procedure. An improvement, not quite as effective as motions for summary judgment, but nevertheless a step in the right direction, one which, however, was very slow to change the culture in the jurisdiction. And then other changes over the following 15 years quickly occurred. Several changes, major changes in the rules of practice of the Superior Court, and then later on the Court of Appeal, which allowed for much tighter case management and which introduced the notion of querulous or quarrelsome litigants, vexatious litigants. On a parallel course, the Code of Civil Procedure was being entirely revised. In 2002, we saw Articles 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, and a number of other things appear in the Code. A revision, or perhaps more accurately, a partial reform, certainly inspired by the Wolf Report in England, which had been a major reform of civil procedure in that jurisdiction. And the rules were changing, but the practices that the rules were meant to regulate were also changing. One example of this shift in the socioeconomic character of litigation, civil litigation in Quebec, is the business of SLAPs, strategic lawsuits against public what? Participation, or poursuites bâillon, as they are known in French, what we call them. Something which was rather unusual and which will be the topic of our first speaker tonight, Professor Roderick MacDonald, who chaired the committee of inquiry formed by the Department of Justice to examine this question. They reported to Justice, I think they were formed in 2006, they reported in 2007, And that led to amendments to the Code of Civil Procedure, which Professor McDonald will describe to you. Why was that solution? The solution chosen by the National Assembly, he has much to say on this topic. Je disais il y a un instant, je passe au français parce que le juge Colin va s'exprimer en français, je disais il y a un instant que la réalité sur laquelle les règles jouent change. Je viens de le dire, on voit maintenant au Québec, c'est un peu un paradoxe, des poursuites civiles qui sont en quelque sorte l'image inversée des slaps, c'est-à-dire des poursuites qui auraient peut-être de bonnes chances de donner un résultat positif si elles procédaient à procès, si elles étaient entendues au fond, mais qui ont été bâillonnées ailleurs et qui sont intentées au Québec en dépit du fait qu'elles n'ont avec le Québec qu'un lien extrêmement ténu ou artificiel. Ce qui évidemment mène à une argumentation fondée sur la doctrine de forum non conveniens, l'article 3135, et le juge Cullen est justement quelqu'un qui a eu à se prononcer dans une de ces poursuites toujours très spectaculaires et médiatisées, dont on entend parler de loin en loin depuis quelques années. Mais ça n'est pas ce dont il va nous parler ce soir. Il va nous parler ce soir de l'autre volet des articles 54.1 et suivants, c'est-à-dire cette partie du Code de procédure civile qui maintenant s'attaque, entre autres choses, directement au phénomène de l'abus de procédure, des parties souvent non représentées qui manifestent un comportement quérulent. Et c'est une question sur laquelle le juge Colin a eu l'occasion de statuer un certain nombre de fois. C'est une question qui continue de soulever des problèmes de principe assez sérieux. À vrai dire, après-demain, une formation de la Cour d'appel du Québec entend un appel au fond, au cours de l'avant-midi, où la question qui est débattue est la suivante. Lorsqu'un recours est rejeté en vertu de l'article 54.3 du Code de procédure civile, la partie défaillante peut-elle, après coup, invoquer l'article 2895 du Code civil et intenter un nouveau recours, malgré le fait qu'en principe, sa demande est prescrite, sous prétexte que le rejet sous 50, je vois que le juge Colin est amusé, je le suis moi aussi, sous prétexte que le rejet sous 54.3 n'est pas un rejet au fond, mais est un rejet sur la forme. J'ignore quelle est la réponse à cette question-là. Je le saurai peut-être la semaine prochaine. Là, j'ai des collègues qui y réfléchissent. Je dirais qu'à l'heure actuelle, le sentiment assez généralisé à la Cour d'appel sur 54.1, c'est que 54.1 devient lui-même un véhicule d'abus de procédure. Ce qui suscite des réactions de vague irritation de la part de certains. Our third speaker, Professor Frédéric Bachan, will speak about a very different order of change, namely the draft bill that's now in the National Assembly to replace the Code of Civil Procedure. It's a bill which is currently being scrutinized by a standing committee of the National Assembly, before which Professor Bachan appeared last week. If adopted, it's going to phase in, some of you may have had the curiosity of looking at it, the terminology is strange, there are many aspects of that bill which I think merit discussion. It will introduce a new concept of civil procedure, indeed a new concept of civil justice, notably because of the very heavy emphasis it places on alternative modes of dispute resolution. So in other words, not only are things in constantly changing, but perhaps it's time to get ready for what will be a massive change. I'm sure that after these 3 hours, you will be better informed, perhaps even some of you wiser, and I hope you very much enjoy the evening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Justice Morissette. You really have brought great insights to this topic and your words to us tonight. And so it now gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, and I am going to get his slides up as I do that, Professor Rod McDonald. Now, this is a man who's not easy to introduce because, frankly, there's just so much to say about him. So I apologize in advance for having to skip over so many important and amazing accomplishments and to try to simply capture the essence of the man. Many of us know Rod MacDonald as a professor, if you were lucky enough to have him while a student here at the faculty. Some as dean of the faculty, a position he served with incredible energy and ambition for the faculty, not himself, from 1984 to 1989, and I was lucky enough to be hired by him during this deanship. Still others have read his innumerable publications in English and in French, in the form of monographs, edited essays, Law Reform Commission reports, government task force reports, and countless journal articles, book chapters, and reviews on topics as varied as secured transactions, access to justice, legal education, and everyday law, to name just a few. But don't worry, Rod MacDonald is one of those rare individuals for whom depth is not sacrificed by breadth. Somehow he manages to do it all. Although an incredibly modest man, and he is likely cringing in his seat as I present him this evening, Professor MacDonald has justly been rewarded with countless awards, prizes, and distinctions. You have to get all the way to page 68 of his CV before he lists, again, too modestly, some of his academic honors and distinctions. There are certainly too many to list here this evening, but a few bear specific mention. These include being elected President of the Royal Society of Canada, a Fellow of the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation, recipient of the Killam Prize, the Raymond Natician Medal, and most recently, La Médaille Paul-André Crépeau. He has received honorary degrees from Osgoode Hall Law School and the Université de Montréal, where I think he was probably the first and only honorary degree recipient to sing and play guitar as his convocation address. But probably the honor of which he is most proud, I got a smile, it's the first smile I got, Rod. But probably the honor of which he is the most proud is the one he most recently received this past November, the university's highest recognition for excellence in teaching, the McGill University Lifetime Achievement Award for Leadership in Learning. This is because, above all, Rod MacDonald is an amazing teacher and mentor to his countless students, both undergraduate and graduate, as well as to his colleagues. En mars 2007, il a déposé au ministre de la Justice du Québec un rapport qu'il a écrit avec la collaboration des professeurs Pierre Noreau et Daniel Jutras, intitulé « Les poursuites stratégiques contre la mobilisation publique, notamment les poursuites Bayon, ou en anglais SLAP, an acronym for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation ». Ce rapport constituait la base d'une réforme législative au Code de procédure civile, notamment dans les nouvelles articles de 54.1 et suivants, mis en vigueur en 2009. Please welcome Professor MacDonald, who will tonight lay out the background to issues attempted to be solved by these new provisions and the problems of SLAPs and how best to deal with them. Rod.
Thank you very much, Rosalie, for that excessive introduction. It's certainly different than one I received 25 years ago from Yoni Goldstein, who introduced me at a Lord Reading law society meeting as follows. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great honor to introduce my friend, Rod MacDonald, who I've known a long time, very long time. I've known him as a child, known him as an adolescent. I've known him as an adult. Unfortunately, too often on the same day." Now, I'm honored, obviously, to be here tonight to talk to you about the subject of SLAP lawsuits, provide an introduction. As was mentioned, I had the privilege of serving on a task force created by the Minister of Justice to deal with or examine the issue. And surprisingly, for these types of organizations, almost all our recommendations were accepted. time will tell whether any recommendations emanating from the inquiry into the construction industry on which I'm now serving will produce a like response from the government. We shall see. My objective this evening is to give you an overview of the context in which the inquiry was established, the rationale for anti-SLAPP legislation, the possible approaches, the choices made by the National Assembly, and a brief assessment of the lessons learned since 2007. Otto von Bismarck is famously reported to have said that war is the continuation of politics by other means. And when I accepted to be chair of the task force, I quickly discovered a corollary to Bismarck's maxim, which is litigation is the continuation of war by other means. Very few lawsuits or threats of lawsuits are brought simply to vindicate a private right. Behind almost every lawsuit is a range of other considerations, strategic, tactical, economic, vindicative, or vindictive, to which the introductory articles of the Code of Civil Procedure give only a hint. And here are the articles that I refer to. You'll notice that all of these articles provide that the purpose of a Code of Civil Procedure is to facilitate the expeditious and effective achievement of a just outcome, and to, there are precatory language here, asking plaintiffs, parties, both parties, to refrain from acting with the intent of causing prejudice or behaving in excessive, unreasonable manner. The proceeding should be proportionate to the nature and purpose of the application. Now, given these foundational principles, which Justice Morissette has already indicated, why did the legislature feel it was necessary in 2006 to re-examine the question by striking a task force to look at a particular litigation problem, SLAPPs? Well, in considering a response, it's helpful to recall the definitional features and patterns of these strategic suits. So first let me give you a start of a definition. The acronym, SLAPP, Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation. A SLAPP is a legal action not truly aimed at vindicating a private right, but rather at stifling public debate on a matter of general interest. That's why in our report we characterize SLAPPs as poursuite bayon. And I'm happy to see that that has now become the consecrated expression to describe SLAPP lawsuits. The archetypal SLAPP lawsuit is the McLibel saga, an English case in which McDonald's restaurants pursued environmental activists because they had produced a pamphlet criticizing McDonald's corporate practices and products. Closer to home, there are a couple of well-known examples of lawsuits that replicate the SLAPP pattern. Consider the following. First, the Subaru case. In 2009, 93 car dealers took legal action against a Quebec City radio journalist on the grounds that the journalist's public comments about Quebec car dealers' inappropriately high prices were defamatory and harmed the dealers' reputations. The Quebec Court of Appeal ruled that the action appeared improper and ordered the car dealers to provide security for costs. Leave to appeal to the Supreme Court was dismissed last week. So if the case goes forward, it will go forward on the basis that the car dealers will fund the costs of the defendant. Of course, just because the resources of the parties are unequal, and just because a lawsuit is based on a claim of defamation, does not make it a SLAPP. Let me give an example. In 2008, a Quebec publishing house, Les Éditions Éco-Société, published a book that criticized the Canadian mining industry's practices, including those of Barrick Gold in Africa. Barrick Gold instituted a defamation action against the publisher and the book's authors. In this case, which was ultimately settled out of court, the question was whether the specific comments made by the defendants were true. Not the general allegations, but specific comments. Now, just because one is confronted with a David and Goliath situation does not necessarily mean that one is in the presence of a genuine SLAPP lawsuit. In Barrick Gold, had the case come to trial and worked its way up through the courts, there's actually a reasonable doubt that it would have been found to be a slap because the comments were demonstrably, or some of them, were demonstrably untrue, even if the general allegations about the practices of Canadian mining companies were true. So a slap is not an all, or the anti-slap legislation is not an all-purpose remedy. The central characteristics of a slap are these. The proceeding must be demonstrably unfounded, frivolous or dilatory, or the proceeding is excessive, unreasonable, or unnecessary. Second, the proceeding causes disproportionate prejudice by imposing legal costs that the defendant doesn't have the financial means to bear. Third, the tactic is not so much to seek financial vindication as it is to compel the defendant to settle the lawsuit by agreeing to cease making the statements which are allegedly defamatory. And fourth, the strategic objective is to use the litigation process to stifle public discussion of the question raised by the defendant, and collaterally to dissuade others from engaging in similar activities. These four elements have to be present before you're in a slap situation. Three is not enough, whatever three they are. Well, what then of the socio-political context of slap lawsuits in Quebec? First, the overwhelming majority of slap lawsuits in North America and in Quebec are brought by business enterprises against citizen or citizen activist groups. It's extremely rare that a lawsuit deemed to be a slap is brought by a corporation against another corporation. Second, it's also rare for an individual carrying on an enterprise to bring a slap-type lawsuit based on defamatory comment directed at him or her personally. When such individuals sue in defamation, it's invariably because the defendant targeted them personally and they're seeking vindication. Even when the defamatory comment is directed towards the individual in a role related to the enterprise, for example, one case, a farmer accused of dumping animal sewage into a stream where children play downstream was characterized as a child killer, quote unquote. In cases like that, it's implausible that the resulting defamation suit would be characterized as a slap. It would go ahead because those comments are clearly defamatory. Third, the bulk of slaps have been suits in defamation, but they need not be. In the U.S., corporate defamation actions are often viewed as slaps because of the high standard one has to meet to succeed in an action in defamation based on the Sullivan and New York Times case. The U.S. courts can quickly determine that a suit in defamation has no reasonable chance of success. In Canada, the standard is much lower, and as a consequence, it's harder to make out the case that a defamation action is abusive. For this reason, it's important that the threshold for determining whether a lawsuit is abusive continue to be cast in general terms and not be tied particularly to proceedings in defamation. Okay, my third point is the problems to which anti-slap legislation is addressed. In our report, we identified three broad policy rationales and one civil procedure reason for anti-slap legislation. First, the state has established certain highly coercive institutions to ensure that disputes can be resolved peacefully and in a manner that respects the basic norms of due process. This is called courts. The state has a corresponding interest in maintaining the integrity and essential purposes of these institutions by, inter alia, ensuring they are not deployed for ulterior and especially abusive purposes. Moreover, slaps by definition exacerbate inequalities of capacity and access to the extent that outsized economic resources of certain places, plaintiffs vis-a-vis certain defendants render justice inaccessible, there is room for legislative intervention. Second, the second reason why slaps should be regulated is that they imply finding a balance between two fundamental yet opposing rights. on the one hand, is the right of an enterprise, an entrepreneur, or a citizen to its good reputation. On the other hand, is the right to freedom of expression. Legislative guidance to courts on how to resolve the resulting conflict is desirable. Anti-SLAPP measures aim at the right of free political expression, a fundamental requisite of a democratic political process. Anti-SLAPP measures are also grounded in the belief that the right to express oneself is inherent in the human person. And that is why notions of defamation tend to be more tolerant of speech directed towards corporations than potentially defamatory speech directed to private citizens. Third, the political process already disproportionately favors more economically endowed interests. SLAPs are typically directed at nonprofit groups that are organized to participate more broadly in the political process, and they're the means by which citizens engage in political activity. To the extent that a particular segment of society uses litigation to limit public debate, we can, to some extent, draw an analogy to large-scale economic interests that try to dominate public debate during election campaigns. The justification for anti-SLAPP measures on public participation grounds is analogous to the justification for limits on campaign spending during elections and limits on corporate rights to engage in advocacy advertising during such campaigns. You will notice the irony in the comparison I draw, given the recent decision of the Supreme Court on the point. Fourth, a fundamental aspect of the rule of law as we know it is that courts should be accessible to all persons who believe they have suffered an infringement of a right, and that all should be entitled to their day in court. For this reason, even though the Code of Civil Procedure has always given judges the authority to dismiss actions that are frivolous or vexatious, judges have been reluctant to do so. In my view, this is a laudable reflex by our judiciary. Before there can be a principle of audi alter impartem, you need a foundational principle, which is called audi prima partem. To protect the openness and objectivity of the litigation process, it's necessary, therefore, to fine-tune the rules of civil procedure so that judges have a menu of options for modulating SLAPs, short of the all-or-nothing option of shutting down a lawsuit at an early stage. Okay. Mechanisms for modulating SLAPs. There are a number of different strategies. The plausibility of some of them that have been adopted elsewhere is, however, questionable. For instance, the law could require, as I believe at one point was the case in Kazakhstan, that all lawsuits and defamation be certified as to their merits by a state official prior to launching the action. This type of state control over what is perceived as a key civil right, the right to one's day in court, certainly is contrary to basic constitutional values in Quebec, and it has been rejected almost everywhere. Similarly, the law could give absolute priority to the right of free speech, creating immunity from lawsuits and defamation for statements made to a commercial enterprise. That is, you won't be able to sue, a corporation that has been defamed won't be able to sue in defamation, is the objective. Some states, like South Australia, have tried this but have backed away from it. The reason why is the approach opens the door to abuses by business competitors of the defamed corporation because they can say whatever they want and never be sued. This approach has been rejected almost everywhere as well. Other strategies are worth more sustained consideration. Broadly speaking, these are four. Ex-ante non-financial preventative or dissuasive measures, ex-ante financial measures, ex-post financial and remedial responses, and ex-post non-financial responses. Take the first. The Quebec Charter of Rights can be amended, or could be amended, explicitly to recognize a fundamental right to speak on matters of public interest free of exposure to suits and defamation. It's one possibility. Second, the Code of Civil Procedure could establish a clear normative foundation to enable judges to assess at the outset of the litigation process whether any particular lawsuit is in fact a SLAPP. Third, the code could establish an accelerated procedure for determining whether a slap meets or a lawsuit meets the slap definition, and therefore should be dismissed or modulated. Fourth, the code could empower judges to intervene more proactively to prevent strategic interlocutory proceedings in cases that do not reach the threshold of summary dismissal, but which warrant some manner of judicial supervision. Second type, financial preventative measures. Fifth, judges could be authorized to impose cautionary costs on suspect slap plaintiffs, such as requiring them to finance the defendant's litigation costs. This is the Subaru case. Sixth, through legal aid or class action fund, or the class action fund, supplementary funding to defend slap lawsuits could be made available to defendants upon application. Financial remedial responses. Courts could be empowered to impose punitive, in the instance treble damages, on slap plaintiffs who have been found to have brought a slap. Eighth, the civil code could be amended to impose personal responsibility on corporate administrators for launching or participating in the decision to launch a slap lawsuit. Ninth, a cause of action could be given to successful slap defendants, a slap back action, shall we call it. Many U.S. jurisdictions permit the plaintiff in such cases, once again, to collect treble damages from the defendant who was the slapping plaintiff. And D, non-financial remedial responses. The court may be given the power to declare a plaintiff that is found to have brought a slap lawsuit to be a frivolous, vexatious, or quarrelsome plaintiff and prohibit the party from instituting legal proceedings except with the authorization of the Chief Justice. This was the menu that we canvassed in our report, and we made several recommendations, I believe. Of that list that I gave you, we made seven recommendations. Ultimately, and now I'm speaking about what the National Assembly did, the National Assembly followed most of them, and I'd just like to remind you of the preamble to the Act which added Sections 54.1 to 54.6. It states, as it is important to promote freedom of expression affirmed in the Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms, as it is important to prevent improper use of the courts and discourage judicial proceedings designed to thwart the right of citizens to participate in public debate, and as it is important to promote access to justice for all citizens and to strike a fair balance between the financial strength of the parties to illegal action, blah, 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 the National Assembly enacts as follows. And what did it do? Section 54.1. Established a clear normative foundation for judges to assess at the outset of litigation whether a lawsuit is in fact a slap. I say a clear normative standard advisedly, because there are parts of 54.1 that, were I the draftsman, I would have drafted a little tighter than what they actually showed up with, but we reported, we didn't draft. Article 54.2 provides for a reverse onus clause. Once a party is able to establish in a preliminary motion that an action or a pleading may be an improper use of procedure, the onus is on the initiator of the action or pleading to show that it's not excessive or unreasonable and is justified in law. Article 54.3 empowers judges to intervene proactively by, among other things, dismissing the action or striking a particular submission. Combined with the summary procedure set out in 54.2, it provides for speedy determinations of whether a lawsuit meets the slap definition and is subject to judicial control. 54.4 amends the cost rules to permit recovery of extrajudicial costs for successful slap defendants, and also grants the court the power to impose punitive damages on slap plaintiffs. Article 54.5 enables a judge to prohibit a quarrelsome party from instituting future actions in the absence of the court's permission. And Article 54.6 provides for the personal liability of corporate directors and officers who participate in a decision relating to a slap. I should say that 54.6 was not one of the recommendations of the task force, but it was added out of the Ministry of Justice between the first reading of the bill and its subsequent revision. So let me conclude. Here are a number of general conclusions that may help us to assess anti-SLAPP efforts. First of all, and you can follow the numbers to see what the little design refers to. First of all, any attempt to deal with SLAPPs must attend to the fact that the problem arises primarily out of corporate action against natural persons. Where an enterprise is unincorporated and lacks legal personality apart from the head of the enterprise, SLAPP lawsuits are infrequent. Second, in the U.S. today, the vast bulk of SLAPPs are brought by little fish in little ponds. Larger corporate entities quickly come to the conclusion that SLAPP-type lawsuits are counterproductive and cause more public relations damage than can be counteracted by the good-feeling advertising campaigns or by feel-good advertising campaigns. One might predict a similar evolution of litigation practice in Quebec. It would surprise me very much that a true SLAPP would be brought in the Barrick Gold case. This is a case where there's a lot more to lose in the realm of public relations. I'm assuming that it's a SLAPP and not a real defamation. Whereas the Subaru case are smaller actors who are more likely, like the local land developer who wants to rip down a mountain to put up condos and is subject to public groups accusing him or her of bad conduct. This is where you're going to see SLAPP-type lawsuits. Third, it may be that those who are inclined to deploy true SLAPPs misread Quebec litigation and political culture. There are no civil juries in Quebec. There are cost-shifting rules for unsuccessful plaintiffs in all lawsuits. There are greater public relations costs to being perceived as a litigation bully in Quebec than there are in most states of the United States. Judges in Quebec are not elected, and as a result, do not depend on significant political contributions to finance their campaigns for re-election. All of these are features of the judicial and litigation process in Quebec, which make it less likely that we'll see a vague of SLAPPs in Quebec the way the late 90s saw in the U.S. Fourth, one already sees an unanticipated and perverse consequences of anti-SLAPP legislation. Environmental groups suing major corporations, bringing class actions against major corporations in the U.S., are being accused of bringing abusive lawsuits that have no purpose other than to throw procedural barriers in the way of projects that have already been approved by the relevant Environmental Protection Agency. These corporate uses of anti-SLAPP provisions are colloquially called slapdash defenses, and they are becoming more frequent. Fifth and finally, the most significant chilling effect today comes from what could be characterized as implied SLAPPs. That is, cases that never get to the issuance of a writ, but achieve their effect by the mere threat of litigation. A party that receives a mise en demeure or lawyer's letters threatening litigation is subject to the same psychological constraints as if it were actually sued. And it will be interesting to see whether the code will be amended to permit potential defendants to invoke a summary procedure requiring the plaintiff to prove that the threatened lawsuit is not a SLAPP. It would be difficult to imagine the drafting of the code to control the issuance of a mise en demeure, but some attempts have been made in states in the United States. And so I return to the corollary to Bismarck's maxim. Litigation is the continuation of war by other means. The state must remain forever vigilant to ensure that the integrity of the institutions and procedures of litigation that it establishes are respected. With the addition of Articles 4.1 and 4.2 in 2002 and 54.1 and 54.6 in 2009, the National Assembly has taken steps to ensure that its courts are not instrumentalized for strategic, tactical, economic, or vindictive reasons. that undermine the goal of expeditious, accessible, and affordable justice. The future will tell how successfully that ambition has been achieved. Thank you very much.
Told you he was worth that introduction. That was really wonderful, Rod. Thank you so much. I know that we're running just about 5 minutes behind schedule. That's not a lot. And I do know that you have another engagement this evening that you have to run to. But I was wondering if at this stage anybody, we could entertain a couple of questions, one or two questions. Go ahead, please. For people, I just have to repeat the question briefly for people that are in across the hall. I'm going to try and make it more concise, but essentially the question is, why does our speaker, or what thoughts does our speaker have on whether 54.1 and following is limited to the classic lawsuit, or whether it has brought in a broader sort of form of summary judgment that can even apply to lawsuits that have been terminated or otherwise discontinued. Is that the essence of the question? Okay, great. Rod.
And the short answer is you're absolutely right. What happened is we were asked to look at a specific question, make a set of recommendations to address that particular question. Our report was taken on board by the Ministry of Justice. There were other interveners in the process by which proposed legislation works its way through, and the government or the Minister of Justice Ministry took a decision that what we had recommended in the specific case of SLAPS should be generalized beyond the target that we were given. But we weren't given a target called abusive lawsuits, we were given a target called SLAPS. But there was a decision taken by the National Assembly to generalize it. So your description of the scope of 54.1 and following is exactly right.
Great, thank you. Anybody else before we go on? We're not leaving this topic, I assure you. We're going to get into the meat and the nitty-gritty of it. Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you, Professor McDonald. I'm wondering, at what point in the process was there a discussion about removing Article 75.1? Did that come as a recommendation from your group, or did that come later on in the process?
Once again, excuse me for repeating for our friends across the hall. The question was, at what time was there a recommendation to remove 75.1 from the Code of Civil Procedure in this report, or at what point did that arise?
In our report, we addressed 75.1. We also addressed 165, and we said that if measures were taken to control SLAPP lawsuits, neither of these would be necessary for the purposes of controlling SLAPP lawsuits. There might be other reasons for wanting to maintain them or not, but that was beyond the scope of our mandate. So we raised the issue but did not have a firm recommendation on the point.
One very last question. Go ahead.
Professor McDonald, I find that we're limiting ourselves to SLAPS. Why doesn't anybody discuss frivolous defenses? Because 54.2, in my mind, has not been applied. What do you have to say about that?
Okay, just again, the question is, why are we talking about SLAPs as opposed to frivolous defenses? How does the court treat that? And 54.2 doesn't seem to be used.
Focusing on the wrong, not the wrong, but other frivolous defenses.
Right. Well, I'm an underpaid academic, and if you'd like to ask the government to ask me to run another task force on frivolous laws, I will do it.
With that, we'll let Rob go to his other appointment tonight and thank him on all our behalf. Thank you so much. It now gives me great pleasure to introduce to you our next speaker, the Honorable Louis-Paul Cullen of the Superior Court of Quebec. When Véronique Bélanger and I conceived of this topic for this Formation Continue evening, we knew that a crucial component of the evening would be a view from the bench. After all, the enactment of Article 54.1 and following has generated incredible litigation. One judge has told me that it is raised in one way or another in just about every case, necessitating two trials instead of one. And yet another judge told me that we need Article 54.1 to counteract Article 54.1 as it is used that much. And this, in fact, was corroborated this evening by our président d'honneur. And he wasn't the judge who told me that. We are therefore incredibly grateful to Justice Cullen for joining us this evening and speaking about Article 54.1 from the front lines, if you will, from the judge's perspective. Monsieur le juge Cullen est diplômé de l'Université de Montréal en sciences biologiques et en droit. Depuis son entrée à la profession de juriste en 1977, il a exercé le droit au sein de l'étude, nommée en ce temps-là, Ogilvie-Renault, jusqu'à 2006. Depuis novembre 2006, il siège comme juge à la Cour supérieure du Québec. La formation juridique comptait toujours parmi les activités communautaires de juge Cullen. Pendant multiples années, il agissait comme chargé de cours à l'École de formation professionnelle du barreau de Québec, ainsi qu'à McGill, où il était chargé de cours en business law. En plus, à beaucoup d'occasions, M. le juge Cullen était conférencier invité à plusieurs congrès et colloques professionnels. Il a même trouvé le temps de publier des articles dans des revues juridiques et des chapitres dans les ouvrages de droit. Juge Cullen, encore une fois, nous sommes très reconnaissantes que vous avez consenti d'être parmi nous ce soir. We are all very anxious to hear your take on Articles 54.1 and following, particularly in the light of some key decisions of both the Superior Court of Quebec and the Court of Appeal. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Justice Louis-Paul Cullen.
I'm quite honored to be with you this evening, and particularly to share this lectern with outstanding members of the academic world, those sitting immediately to my right, as well as Professor MacDonald. I must add that I am particularly thrilled to be here because, well, approximately 30 years ago, I used to come here after a hard day's work without having supper, and this is quite familiar to me, trying to impart some of my thoughts on matters that I held close to heart. McGill is the place where my only daughter is presently studying in third year, Well, she gave me a bit of advice that I'm frankly puzzled to implement. She told me, Dad, you're too serious. Let your hair down. And my reaction was, mon exposé sera divisé en trois parties. Dans la première, je propose de passer rapidement en revue les articles 54.1 et suivants du Code de procédure civile. Dans la deuxième partie, je soulèverai quelques questions inspirées par la jurisprudence relativement à ces dispositions. Dans la troisième partie, je me permettrai quelques observations afin de m'efforcer à répondre à vos questions. Mais avant toute chose, quelques mises au point. Mes propos ce soir ne constituent pas des jugements. J'apprécierais donc que vous vous absteniez de les citer à des collègues ou, pire encore, de me les rappeler, car mon point de vue évoluera sans doute à la lumière des enseignements futurs de la Cour d'appel. Bien entendu, je ne commenterai aucune cause pendante. Mes propos ne reflètent pas nécessairement le point de vue de la Cour supérieure ni d'un seul autre juge que moi-même. Je compte sur votre indulgence car je n'ai aucune prétention de pouvoir répondre correctement à toutes vos questions. Enfin, il va de soi qu'il m'est impossible de couvrir l'intégralité du sujet dans le temps qui m'est accordé. Mon propos vise à vous renseigner jusqu'à un certain point, mais surtout à vous éveiller à l'importance pratique du sujet traité. Une mise en contexte s'impose sans doute. Dans un monde idéal, l'instance se déroule aussi rapidement que possible et au moindre coût possible, compte tenu de la nature, de la finalité, de la complexité du litige. Pour favoriser le cheminement normal de l'instance, la loi impose des obligations aux parties. L'article 6 du Code civil du Québec formule le principe élémentaire que toute partie se doit d'exercer ses droits civils de bonne foi. L'article 7 du Code civil ajoute un volet concret à l'article 6 en interdisant l'exercice d'un droit en vue de nuire à autrui ou d'une manière excessive et déraisonnable allant à l'encontre des exigences de la bonne foi. L'article 4.1 du Code de procédure civile reconnaît que les parties sont maîtresses de leur dossier dans le respect des règles de procédure et des délais prévus au Code de procédure civile. L'article 4.1 du Code de procédure fait le pont avec les articles 6 et 7 du Code civil en précisant que les parties sont tenues de ne pas agir en vue de nuire à autrui ou d'une manière excessive ou déraisonnable, allant ainsi à l'encontre des exigences de la bonne foi. En somme, le droit d'ester en justice n'est pas absolu. L'article 4.1 rappelle par ailleurs que le tribunal veille au bon déroulement de l'instance, et intervient pour en assurer la saine gestion. Les parties à l'instance ne sont donc pas seules à bord. La jurisprudence est déjà riche en enseignements. Permettez-moi de vous présenter certains de ceux-ci de façon modestement interactive. En effet, je crois qu'il serait amusant de tester vos connaissances, ou à tout le moins votre instinct, relativement à la jurisprudence existante. Voici ce que je vous propose. Je pose une question dont la réponse est oui ou non. Vous votez à main levée, puis je vous livre la réponse selon la jurisprudence. Sachez que les réponses que je vous livrerai sont surtout tirées d'arrêts de la Cour d'appel, ou de décisions rendues par un juge seul de la Cour d'appel. Mais avant de passer aux questions, je vous invite à me suivre dans un survol rapide des nouvelles dispositions, histoire d'améliorer vos chances de bien répondre au quiz qui suivra. Il convient d'abord de situer le sujet. Les dispositions nouvelles s'intègrent au chapitre 3 du titre 1er du Code de procédure civile qui traite des pouvoirs des tribunaux et des juges. La première section de ce chapitre porte sur les pouvoirs généraux des tribunaux et des juges. L'article 46 décrit ces pouvoirs comme suit et il mérite qu'on le cite. Les tribunaux et les juges ont tous les pouvoirs nécessaires à l'exercice de leurs compétences. Ils peuvent en tout temps et en toute matière, tant en première instance qu'en appel, prononcer des ordonnances de sauvegarde des droits des parties pour le temps et aux conditions qu'ils déterminent. De plus, ils peuvent, dans les affaires dont ils sont saisis, prononcer même d'office des injonctions ou des réprimandes, supprimer des écrits ou les déclarer calomnieux et rendre toute ordonnance appropriée pour pourvoir au cas où la loi n'a pas prévu de remède spécifique. La deuxième section du même chapitre traite du pouvoir des tribunaux et des juges de punir pour outrage au tribunal. La troisième section complète le chapitre et traite du pouvoir de sanctionner les abus de la procédure. Cette nouvelle section comporte six nouveaux articles que nous allons parcourir sommairement, tour à tour. L'article 54.1 est introductif. Le premier alinéa indique que le tribunal peut déclarer qu'un acte de procédure est abusif et prononcer une sanction contre la partie dont il émane. Il précise que la déclaration d'abus et la sanction peuvent être prononcées à tout moment durant l'instance, même d'office, mais seulement après que les parties aient été entendues sur le point. Le deuxième alinéa de l'article 54.1 énumère un amalgame de situations pouvant constituer un abus de la procédure. Il mérite qu'on s'y attarde brièvement. L'abus entraînant une sanction peut se rapporter soit à un acte de procédure, soit à un comportement. Quant à un acte de procédure, l'abus peut résulter d'une procédure manifestement mal fondée, c'est-à-dire certainement vouée à l'échec, frivole, c'est-à-dire sans fondement apparent, ou dilatoire, c'est-à-dire dont le but unique ou principal est de retarder le déroulement normal de l'instance. L'abus lié à un comportement peut résulter d'un comportement vexatoire, qui est fait pour blesser, pour nuire, quérulent, c'est-à-dire qui multiplie les recours sans fondement ou qui refuse d'accepter la finalité d'un jugement antérieur ou d'une partie d'un jugement antérieur. De la mauvaise foi, par exemple le défaut intentionnel de ne pas tenir ses engagements ou de ne pas respecter les échéances convenues ou imposées. De l'utilisation de la procédure de manière excessive, c'est-à-dire disproportionnée à la nature et la finalité de la demande et à la complexité du litige, déraisonnable, c'est-à-dire insensée ou absurde, de manière à nuire à autrui ou du détournement de la procédure des fins de la justice, par exemple la poursuite Bayon. Le premier alinéa de l'article 54.2 précise le fardeau respectif des parties. Celui qui allègue l'abus n'a qu'à établir sommairement que la procédure visée peut constituer un abus pour que la partie dont elle émane soit tenue de démontrer que son geste n'est pas exercé de manière déraisonnable ou excessive et se justifie en droit. On remarquera que le fardeau de celui qui allègue l'abus n'est pas d'établir l'abus, mais uniquement l'apparence d'abus. Le fardeau se déplace ensuite sur la partie dont émane la procédure qui n'a pas à établir le bien fondé de sa procédure, mais uniquement que celle-ci est compatible avec les exigences de la bonne foi et qu'elle n'est pas vouée à l'échec au plan juridique. Le deuxième alinéa de l'article 54.2 précise que la requête visant à faire rejeter la demande en raison de son caractère abusif est présentée en première instance à titre de moyen préliminaire. Notez qu'il s'agit uniquement du rejet et non d'une autre sanction, et de la demande en justice, pas d'une autre procédure. En vertu de l'article 159 du Code de procédure, ce moyen préliminaire pourrait être visé par l'entente entre les parties conformément à l'article 151.1 ou dénoncé par écrit avant la date de présentation de la demande introductive d'instance, à défaut de quoi le tribunal pourra refuser sa présentation. Il convient de rappeler que l'article 9 du Code de procédure civile permet bien sûr au juge de proroger tout délai qui n'est pas de rigueur. L'article 54.3 énonce quelques interventions possibles du tribunal en cas d'abus constaté ou apparent. Le premier alinéa de l'article 54.3 énumère 6 sanctions ou redressements possibles en cas d'abus constaté. Le juge peut rejeter la procédure visée, supprimer une conclusion, exiger la modification d'une conclusion, refuser un interrogatoire ou y mettre fin, ou encore annuler le bref d'assignation d'un témoin. En cas d'abus, le juge n'est pas limité à ses moyens d'intervention, car il dispose également des moyens d'intervention prévus au deuxième alinéa de l'article 54.3, ainsi que les moyens d'intervention prévus aux articles 54.4 jusqu'à point 6 que nous allons voir tout à l'heure. Par ailleurs, lorsque le juge ne constate pas l'existence d'un abus, mais estime qu'il pourrait y avoir abus, il dispose des 5 moyens d'intervention mentionnés à l'article 54.3. Je vous fais grâce de leur énumération. Le premier alinéa de l'article 54.4 énumère des sanctions possibles en cas de déclaration d'abus, soit le remboursement forcé de la provision versée pour les frais de l'instance, la condamnation d'une partie aux dommages-intérêts résultant de l'abus, y compris ses honoraires et débours extrajudiciaires, ainsi que des dommages-intérêts punitifs. Le deuxième alinéa de l'article 54.4 prévoit la marche à suivre dans l'attribution des dommages-intérêts. Le tribunal les accorde au moment de la déclaration d'abus s'ils sont admis ou s'ils peuvent être aisément établis. Sinon, le tribunal peut trancher la question sommairement dans le délai sous les conditions qu'il détermine. Il en reste deux.
L'article 54.5 confirme le pouvoir du tribunal qui constate la quérulence d'une partie d'assujettir l'introduction de toute demande en justice de sa part à l'autorisation préalable du juge en chef et aux conditions déterminées par celui-ci, et ce, en plus d'imposer toute autre sanction disponible en cas d'abus. L'article 54.6 complète la nouvelle section concernant le pouvoir de sanctionner les abus de procédure. Il confirme la possibilité de condamner personnellement au paiement des dommages et intérêts des administrateurs et dirigeants d'une personne morale ayant abusé de la procédure ou l'administrateur du bien d'autrui qui a lui-même abusé de la procédure. Nous voilà rendus au quiz. Alors, je rappelle les règles du jeu. Je pose une question, ensuite je prends vos votes à main levée. J'annoncerai le résultat pour le bénéfice des personnes qui se trouvent dans l'autre salle. Peut-on imposer une sanction, en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants, même si la procédure visée paraît bien fondée en fait ou en droit? Je répète. Peut-on imposer une sanction en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants, même si la procédure visée paraît bien fondée en fait ou en droit? Qui dit oui? Non? La majorité va au oui. Réponse, oui. Car indépendamment de son fondement factuel ou juridique, une procédure peut être abusive quant à sa finalité, entre autres. Par exemple, on peut imaginer les cas d'une action en diffamation dont les éléments constitutifs essentiels, faute, préjudice et lien de causalité, sont présents, mais qui a pour but véritable de brimer la liberté d'expression de la partie ciblée. Deuxième question. Peut-on imposer une sanction en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants du seul fait qu'une procédure est mal fondée? Je répète, peut-on imposer une sanction en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants du seul fait qu'une procédure est mal fondée? Qui dit oui? Très minoritaire. Non? Très majoritaire. Réponse? Non. L'existence d'une conduite blâmable doit également être démontrée. Deux arrêts de la Cour d'appel le confirment. Troisième question. Une procédure manifestement mal fondée est-elle forcément abusive? Je répète, une procédure manifestement mal fondée est-elle forcément abusive? Qui dit oui? Attention, chacun son tour. Qui dit oui? On lève la main, ceux qui disent oui ou celles. Non? Écrasante majorité en faveur du non. La réponse, c'est « je ne crois pas ». Je vous assure que j'ai fait de bon mieux de dégager de la jurisprudence une réponse claire. Je n'y suis pas parvenu encore et je vous prie de m'en excuser. Lorsqu'une procédure est manifestement mal fondée au sens de l'article 54.1, non seulement est-elle mal fondée, mais elle est intentée d'une manière ou dans des circonstances si évidentes, frivoles ou dilatoires qu'il est fort possible qu'il s'agisse d'un abus de la procédure. Mais l'article 75.2 du Code de procédure civile, maintenant abrogé, laissait clairement au tribunal la discrétion de déclarer abusive ou dilatoire une procédure rejetée en vertu de l'article 75.1 au motif qu'elle était manifestement mal fondée ou frivole. Ainsi, le rejet de la procédure manifestement mal fondée n'entraînait pas nécessairement une déclaration qu'elle était abusive. Pourquoi en serait-il autrement aujourd'hui? L'avenir nous le dira. Question suivante. Peut-on disposer dans un seul jugement de requêtes en rejet qui combinent des motifs d'irrecevabilité en vertu de l'article 165.4 et d'abus de procédure en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants? Je répète. Peut-on disposer dans un seul jugement de requête en rejet qui combine des motifs d'irrecevabilité en vertu de l'article 165.4 et d'abus de procédure en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Le oui l'emporte. Effectivement, la réponse est oui. Il est possible dans un même jugement de trancher des requêtes en rejet qui combinent les motifs d'irrecevabilité et d'abus de procédure et la jurisprudence serait longue à énumérer. Doit-on traiter d'un sujet avant l'autre? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Faible majorité du oui, je dirais que les abstentions sont nettement majoritaires. La crainte est-elle le commencement de la sagesse? Alors, la réponse est oui. Le moyen fondé sur l'article 165, paragraphe 4, doit être analysé d'abord et avant celui invoquant l'article 54.1. Question suivante. Le tribunal saisi d'une requête en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants doit-il tenir pour avérer les faits allégués par la partie dont émane la procédure? Je répète. Le tribunal saisi d'une requête en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants doit-il tenir pour vrai les faits allégués par la partie dont émane la procédure? Oui ou non? Oui? Qui dit oui? Il est dit non? Majorité écrasante en faveur du non et la réponse est non. Non, l'évaluation par le tribunal de l'existence ou de l'apparence d'un abus tient cependant compte des procédures et de la preuve au dossier, des pièces, des interrogatoires, et ainsi de suite. Prochaine question. Le tribunal saisi d'une requête en vertu de l'article 54.1 peut-il recevoir des éléments de preuve additionnels qui ne sont pas déjà au dossier? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Majorité forte en faveur du oui? Effectivement, oui. Par exemple, un interrogatoire préalable ou sur affidavit. Il va falloir être très attentif à la prochaine question. C'est une question piège. Vous êtes prévenus. Le tribunal peut-il interdire aux deux parties d'introduire une demande en justice à moins d'obtenir l'autorisation du juge en chef? Je répète, ça vous donne l'occasion d'y penser. Le tribunal peut-il interdire aux deux parties d'introduire une demande en justice à moins d'obtenir l'autorisation du juge en chef? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Majorité substantielle en faveur du oui. Et la réponse est oui. Un exemple, des disputes entre parents depuis 9 ans au sujet d'un enfant. Le tribunal peut-il fixer une limite temporelle à son interdiction d'introduire une demande en justice à moins d'obtenir l'autorisation du juge en chef? Est-ce qu'on peut imposer une limite dans le temps à l'interdiction? Oui ou non? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Forte majorité du oui, et la réponse est bien oui. En l'espèce, 2 ans. Lorsque la partie a établi que la procédure peut constituer un abus, l'autre partie est-elle alors présumée être de mauvaise foi? Je répète. Lorsque la partie a établi que la procédure peut constituer un abus, l'autre partie est-elle alors présumée être de mauvaise foi? Qui dit oui? Alors, c'est un oui affirmatif. Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres oui? Des non. Alors, forte majorité du non. Eh bien, la réponse est non. La partie bénéficie toujours de la présomption de bonne foi prévue à l'article 28.05 du Code civil du Québec. Le tribunal doit-il ordonner l'exécution provisoire du jugement prononçant une sanction pour abus de procédure? Je répète, le tribunal doit-il ordonner l'exécution provisoire du jugement prononçant une sanction pour abus de procédure? Oui ou non? Ah, j'ai des élèves attentifs et éveillés. Oui? Non? Forte majorité en faveur du non. La réponse, c'est non. Car l'exécution provisoire est automatique en vertu de l'article 547J du Code de procédure civile, même si le jugement est silencieux à cet égard. Le tribunal peut toutefois suspendre l'exécution de son jugement par décision motivée. Le jugement rejetant une demande en justice en raison de son caractère abusif est-il appelable de plein droit? Le jugement rejetant une demande... Ne soufflez pas les réponses. Le jugement rejetant une demande en justice en raison de son caractère abusif est-il appelable de plein droit? Oui. Mais attendez que j'ai fini la réponse. Oui ou... Ça, c'est monsieur oui. Oui ou non? Oui? Non? Alors, forte majorité en faveur du oui, eh bien, c'est non. Ce fut dur, mais... Bon. Non, en vertu de l'article 26, alinéa 2, paragraphe 4.1 du Code de procédure civile, ce jugement n'est appelable que sur permission, lorsque la question en jeu en est une qui devrait être soumise à la Cour d'appel, ce qui est notamment le cas si le juge est d'avis que la question en jeu est une question de principe, une question nouvelle ou une question de droit faisant l'objet d'une jurisprudence contradictoire. Prochaine question. L'appel d'un jugement interdisant à une partie d'introduire une demande en justice à moins d'obtenir l'autorisation du juge en chef est-il assujetti à une permission? Alors, situons-nous. Vous voyez l'article 54.5. L'appel du jugement interdisant à une partie d'introduire une demande en justice à moins d'obtenir l'autorisation du juge en chef est-il assujetti à une permission? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Les abstinents sont nombreux. Alors, c'est non. Il n'y avait pas de majorité. Le jugement déclarant un plaideur vexatoire est appelable de plein droit. Prochaine question. Le jugement qui prononce une condamnation des dommages et intérêts en application des articles 54.1 et suivants est-il appelable de plein droit? Je répète. Alors, nous voyons... Ici, 54.4, possibilité de condamnation des dommages et intérêts. Alors, le jugement qui prononce une condamnation des dommages et intérêts en application de cette disposition est-il appelable de plein droit? Qui dit oui? Le futé. Qui dit non? C'est pas clair. On reprend le vote. Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Les noms l'emportent, mais la majorité est fragile. Eh bien, c'est un oui. Si la valeur de l'objet en litige excède 50 000 $. Bravo, bravo. La jurisprudence découlant des articles 75.1 et 75.2, maintenant abrogés, demeure-t-elle encore pertinente? Alors, la jurisprudence découlant des articles 75.1 et 75.2, maintenant abrogés, demeure-t-elle encore pertinente? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Forte majorité, professeur Bacha, vous viendrez boire après la classe. C'est oui. C'est oui. C'est dommage. Je vous en prie. Alors oui, particulièrement quant aux notions de frivolité et d'actes de procédure manifestement mal fondés, ainsi qu'au principe que le rejet d'une procédure doit être appliqué avec la plus grande prudence et reposer sur la conviction du tribunal qu'elle est manifestement mal fondée. La partie qui allègue un détournement des fins de la justice doit-elle établir l'intention blâmable de la partie dont la procédure émane? Je répète, la partie qui allègue un détournement des fins de la justice doit-elle établir l'intention blâmable de la partie dont la procédure émane? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Forte majorité en faveur du non? Oui. Alors, attention, attention. Le détournement des fins de justice suppose une procédure intentée de mauvaise foi pour contrer l'exercice légitime d'un droit par une autre personne, ce qui contrevient à l'article 4.1 du Code de procédure civile. Peut-on établir cette intention sur la base des effets d'une action en diffamation dont on allègue le caractère abusif? Je répète, peut-on établir cette intention en l'inférant à partir des effets de l'action en diffamation dont on allègue le caractère abusif? Qui dit oui? Qui n'a pas compris la question? Bon, qui dit non pour la forme, c'est égal. Alors voici, la réponse c'est oui, on peut établir l'intention blâmable sur la base des effets d'une action en diffamation dont on allègue le caractère abusif, mais uniquement lorsque l'effet de la demande jugée abusive sur la liberté d'expression est excessif ou disproportionné, puisqu'il va de soi que tout recours en diffamation relativement à des débats publics n'est pas abusif en soi. Le pouvoir discrétionnaire du tribunal d'imposer un redressement approprié en cas d'abus apparent est-il illimité? Je répète, et la question mérite d'être répétée. Le pouvoir discrétionnaire du tribunal d'imposer le redressement approprié, oui, je vois. Merci, pardon. La technologie. Alors, le pouvoir discrétionnaire du tribunal d'imposer un redressement approprié en cas d'abus apparent est-il illimité? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? La grande majorité dit non. La réponse est non. Le redressement approprié devra être proportionnel à la gravité de l'abus apparent et conforme aux règles de droit pertinentes. Le redressement imposé ne peut pas créer de droits ni contredire des dispositions législatives. Alors, par exemple, on ne peut s'autoriser de l'article 54.3 pour imposer un cautionnement en matière familiale, puisque l'article 813.4.1 du Code de procédure civile l'interdit. Lorsqu'il y a existence, lorsqu'on constate un abus apparent, le tribunal peut-il ordonner un cautionnement pour frais? Alors, lorsqu'il y a apparence d'abus, peut-on ordonner un cautionnement pour frais? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Je pense que c'est tous oui, personne non. La réponse est oui. Le tribunal peut assujettir la poursuite de la demande aux conditions qu'il estime appropriées en cas d'abus apparent, et ce, en vertu du premier paragraphe du deuxième alinéa de l'article 54.3. Ces conditions devront toutefois être proportionnelles à la gravité de l'abus apparent. Nous achevons. Ou vous achevez. Le cautionnement pour frais peut-il comprendre les frais extrajudiciaires? Le cautionnement pour frais peut-il comprendre les frais extrajudiciaires? Il dit oui. Il dit non. Forte, quasi-totalité en faveur du oui. Et la réponse est oui. Car si l'abus apparent est éventuellement déclaré, le tribunal peut sanctionner en attribuant des dommages-intérêts en vertu de l'article 54.4, notamment pour compenser les honoraires et les bourses extrajudiciaires. Le cautionnement pour frais peut-il comprendre les dommages-intérêts punitifs? Le cautionnement pour frais peut-il comprendre les dommages-intérêts punitifs? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Forte majorité du non. Réponse, ça reste à décider. La partie qui obète se présenter sans justification à un interrogatoire préalable s'expose-t-elle au rejet de sa procédure en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants? La partie qui omet de se présenter sans justification à un interrogatoire préalable s'expose-t-elle au rejet de sa procédure en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Majorité timorée en faveur du oui, et la réponse est oui. Le défaut de répondre convenablement aux engagements, retard, réticence, imprécision, peut-il être sanctionné en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants? Alors, le défaut de répondre convenablement aux engagements, undertakings, retard, réticence, imprécision, peut-il être sanctionné en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Forte majorité en faveur du oui, et c'est oui. L'avocat qui rédige une procédure abusive, 2010 QCCA, paragraphe 2. 2015, paragraphe 2. L'avocat qui rédige une procédure abusive ou tente de détourner les fins de la justice peut-il être condamné personnellement aux dépens? Ça mérite que je répète. Lentement. L'avocat qui rédige une procédure abusive ou tente de détourner les fins de la justice peut-il être condamné personnellement aux dépens? Qui dit oui? Qui dit non? Forte majorité en faveur... Ah, très forte majorité en faveur du oui. Eh bien, en matière de faillite... Même d'office, la réponse est oui. Nous le savons. Le juge Dalphon, dans l'arrêt Mikalakopoulos contre Sam Levy et associés, écrivait ce qui suit et ça mérite d'être répété. Commentant l'arrêt Pacifique Mobile, mon collègue Yves-Marie Morissette, alors professeur de droit, écrit dans l'initiative judiciaire vouée à l'échec et la responsabilité de l'avocat ou de son mandant, c'est publié dans 1984, 44 Revue du Barreau, 397, que la condamnation de l'avocat constitue la sanction la plus immédiate et la plus radicale du recours voué à l'échec, car elle survient dans l'instance même qu'on qualifie d'inutile et elle s'apparente aux condamnations pour outrage au tribunal. Il ajoute que la mesure est à la fois punitive dans son imposition et compensatoire dans son effet. Le juge Dalphon poursuit. Il est vrai que la jurisprudence enseigne qu'avant de prononcer la condamnation personnelle d'un avocat aux dépens, généralement personnellement plutôt que solidairement avec ses clients, le juge doit lui accorder un ajournement adéquat afin de lui donner la chance de prendre position si nécessaire après avoir consulté ou dans certains cas avoir retenu un avocat, à moins qu'il s'agisse d'un cas exceptionnel où cela serait manifestement inutile. Alors, que faut-il retenir? D'abord, ce qui ne constitue pas un abus de la procédure. L'exercice légitime de ses droits est compatible avec un dur combat, pourvu qu'il s'agisse d'un combat loyal. Une procédure n'est pas abusive si elle est intentée pour des motifs légitimes, paraît avoir des chances de succès et se fonde sur des faits que la partie a des motifs raisonnables de croire vrais. Le fait qu'une procédure soit vouée à l'échec ou même son échec n'est pas synonyme d'abus. Pour conclure à l'abus, il ne suffit pas de constater un oubli, un manque de diligence ou la négligence d'un avocat à l'égard de l'échéancier ou des engagements. Mais qu'est-ce qui constitue un abus de la procédure? On reconnaît l'abus à des indices de mauvaise foi, c'est-à-dire l'intention de causer des désagréments plutôt que de faire reconnaître le bien fondé de ses prétentions, ou à des indices de témérité, c'est-à-dire lorsqu'une personne raisonnable et prudente, placée dans les circonstances connues par la partie, conclurait à l'absence de fondement de la procédure. D'une manière générale, l'abus se caractérise par une conduite judiciaire répréhensible, soit tout un spectre qui englobe la mauvaise foi, la témérité, le mépris évident pour les règles de procédure ou pour le contrat judiciaire et le détournement des fins de justice. L'abus sur le fond du litige doit être distingué, bien sûr, de l'abus de procédure. L'abus sur le fond se rapporte à la conduite alléguée fautive d'une partie avant les procédures judiciaires. Par ailleurs, l'abus de procédure caractérise plutôt la faute commise à l'occasion de recours judiciaire. Il peut s'agir, par exemple, d'une demande ou d'une défense entreprise de mauvaise foi, c'est-à-dire dans l'intention de nuire et en sachant qu'on n'a aucun droit à faire valoir, d'un acte de procédure téméraire, c'est-à-dire entrepris sans cause raisonnable ou probable, d'une multiplication des procédures ou de la poursuite abusive d'un débat judiciaire. Retenons que toutes les procédures judiciaires sont assujetties aux articles 54.1 et suivants, quelle qu'en soit la nature et non pas seulement les poursuites Bayon. La sanction de l'abus constaté ou de l'apparence d'abus est désormais à géométrie variable. Cette sanction est laissée à la discrétion du tribunal, le tribunal devant alors exercer son pouvoir de manière raisonnable. L'objectif est de prévenir ou supprimer les conséquences de l'abus constaté ou apparent et préserver ou restaurer l'intégrité de la fonction judiciaire. Comme il se doit, le tribunal n'ordonnera le rejet d'une procédure que s'il est en présence d'un cas d'abus grave et clair. Il faut exercer avec modération le pouvoir de mettre fin au litige pour cause d'abus, tenir compte de la proportionnalité de la sanction au manquement, ainsi que de la meilleure administration de la justice. La sanction appropriée sera modulée en fonction de l'ensemble des éléments pertinents du dossier, y compris la constatation de l'existence d'un abus ou encore de son apparence, sa gravité, l'acte de procédure visé, action, défense, procédure interlocutoire, etc., et les conséquences de la sanction sur le déroulement équitable du litige entre les plaideurs. Le Code de procédure civile utilise le mot « sanction », car l'abus de procédure menace l'intégrité du processus judiciaire. Non seulement l'abus de procédure est-il injuste envers la partie qui en est victime, mais il retarde l'accès à la justice des autres plaideurs. Cette injustice et ces retards imposent des coûts inutiles à la victime immédiate et aux autres justiciables, également victimes par ricochet. Des collègues me confient qu'ils ont l'impression que les requêtes en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants sont devenues monnaie courante. Je partage cette impression. Il n'est pas exceptionnel qu'une requête en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants soit présentée par la demande et la défense. Les parties abusent-elles régulièrement de la procédure dans la province de Québec? Je n'ai pas accès à des statistiques officielles, s'il en existe, quant au nombre de demandes formulées en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants depuis leur entrée en vigueur en 2009. Mais une recherche rapide à l'aide d'une banque informatisée révèle que l'article 54.1 est cité dans le résumé de près de 350 jugements, toutes juridictions confondues, dont plus de 75 décisions de la Cour d'appel ou de l'un de ses juges. Les avocats sont-ils complaisants à l'égard des abus de la procédure, si tant est qu'ils n'en soient pas les instigateurs? La multiplication de ces requêtes entraînera-t-elle un certain cynisme à l'égard des requérants qui se disent victimes d'abus? En somme, abuse-t-on de la requête visant à sanctionner l'abus? Je ne connais pas les réponses à ces questions épineuses. Je constate que la jurisprudence est fixée quant à la nécessité de faire preuve d'une grande prudence avant de rejeter une procédure en totalité ou en partie au motif qu'elle est abusive. Cela devrait freiner les ardeurs de certains plaideurs portés à banaliser les demandes de rejet en vertu des articles 54.1 et suivants. À l'inverse, j'ai le sentiment que la jurisprudence n'a pas fini d'évoluer relativement à l'imposition de sanctions autres que le rejet en cas d'abus constaté ou apparent de la procédure. Je pense, entre autres, à la responsabilité personnelle du procureur. L'avocat est un professionnel soumis à un code de déontologie pour la protection de ses clients et l'intégrité du processus judiciaire. Il doit éviter la complaisance ou, pire, la complicité à l'égard d'initiatives judiciaires malveillantes ou frivoles d'un client. En amont de la signification d'une procédure, l'avocat doit s'assurer qu'il existe des motifs raisonnables et probables à son soutien. En aval, il doit formuler celle-ci avec modération. L'avocat ne peut pas se réfugier à bon droit derrière les instructions déraisonnables d'un client. L'avocat qui se rend complice de la faute civile de son client à l'endroit de la partie adverse s'expose à des sanctions disciplinaires et risque d'engager sa responsabilité personnelle. Or, la réputation d'un avocat, surtout d'un plaideur, constitue son bien le plus précieux. Cette réputation tient en bonne partie à sa crédibilité, chose fragile, et dont il convient de prendre un soin jaloux. Ne serait-il pas sage pour l'avocat d'éviter de mettre en péril sa réputation, sa carrière et ses biens personnels? Access to civil justice has long been of concern. British writer and humorist Jerome K. Jerome, born in 1859, reportedly thought the following about the cost of civil justice in his day. If a man stopped me in the street and demanded of me my watch, I should refuse to give it to him. If he threatened to take it by force, I feel I should, though not a fighting man, do my best to protect it. If, on the other hand, he should assert his intention of trying to obtain it by means of an action in any court of law, I should take it out of my pocket and hand it to him and think I had got off cheaply. I read this morning in La Presse under Lisiane Gagnon's pen that sociologists claim that in every society 10% of the people are scum, 10% are heroes, and the balance followers. One would rather be part of the solution than of the problem. The problem may not be limited to antisocial professional conduct. The problem includes, perhaps, that we take access to civil justice for granted. The necessity of maintaining real access to civil justice is undeniable. Without it, what would parties do if all other means of conflict resolution failed? Access to civil justice doesn't exist if civil justice is unaffordable. Longer trials result in ever-increasing costs. More parties choose self-representation. New cases are fewer. Which of you today could afford hiring yourself as counsel in a civil dispute? The question is, why? Litigators cooperating with each other in the best interest of their respective clients, focusing relentlessly on decisive issues, and rigorously deploying procedural means that are strictly commensurate to the stakes, should not only enjoy a competitive edge before the courts, but attract clients as well. Courts and litigators alike face a formidable challenge. Let's all do something about it. Thank you.
Wow, that was amazing. Please tell your daughter she did exactly what she told you to do. You let down your hair, and at the same time, while really entertaining us, you educated us, and I really, really have to thank you so, so much. Now, you asked us many questions. I hope we passed. Did we pass?
I believe I have a question.
I was going to say, you've asked us many questions, so I know we really want to break, but let's spend a few minutes, because I think there are a lot of people who would like to ask a question. Go ahead. Je vais répéter brièvement la question pour les gens à l'autre côté du corridor. La question, est-ce qu'il y a une réticence parmi les juges d'appliquer l'article 54.2 quand ça concerne une défense mal fondée?
Now, let's assume, solely for argument's sake, that I were to agree with you, solely for discussion purposes. Now, where would be the tar drum? Literally, each case stands on the merits of its own facts, on the merits or demerits of the pleadings. And there's no doubt that the principle has been established on more than one occasion that a party may move to have a defense struck or to have conditions or sanctions imposed on the pursuance of the defense. So as a matter of principle, certainly that is behind us. That's water under the bridge. As a matter of application, well, that's a matter to be decided on the merits of every single case.
That's it. We have a question here.
Isn't the threshold question the following? These rules are nice and fine, and they establish normative criteria. But in a litigation context, isn't the mechanism for determining whether something is frivolous and vexatious the discovery process? So I think that is the principle that was established by 75.1. Once you go through a discovery process, then you can petition the court to dismiss a case as being or a defense or a proceeding as being frivolous and vexatious precisely because you've gone through a discovery process. Without the benefit of a discovery process where salient elements come out during that particular context, isn't it very difficult for the court to take the initiative, answering my colleague's question, isn't it very difficult for the court to take the initiative to summarily dismiss something? And the question is, why did the legislator decide to abrogate 75.1 and that whole process?
Okay, very, very quickly, 75.1 used to require an examination on discovery before you could take an action, a motion to dismiss a case. That has been changed under 54.1. As we know, it's at any time. And the question is, I guess, is that a wise decision, or why did the legislator do it, or what does Justice Cullen think of that?
Well, let's deal with 75.1 first. It used to require either the demonstration through an examination held under the provisions of the code that the action was frivolous or manifestement mal fondé, clearly unfounded, or a party's failure to submit to an examination. The new rules are broader. This need not be the case. And if there's one case that I would strongly recommend that everybody in this room read for their for getting the, I think, the broadest possible indication of what these new provisions stand for, what they mean, and how they should be applied, is the Acadia Subaru versus Michaud, against Michaud case. And that stands as an example of the application of those rules without the benefit of an examination on discovery and the imposition of a mesure de redressement, a balancing measure, which was to provide for a provision of costs. So perhaps one would think that, conceptually speaking, it is more likely that an examination will show the absence of cause, or, but who knows? It's really on a case-to-case basis. And my suggestion would be that rather than focusing entirely on the dismissal of an action or of a defense, think about the other measures to balance the playing field. And while courts will be understandably, I think, reluctant to dismiss outright proceedings unless it's clearly in abuse, my impression is that we will be perhaps more generous, but certainly more very attentive to situations which merit another form of redress.
Maybe one more question.
Merci, Monsieur le Président.
Je vous en prie, c'est mon plaisir.
Thank you.
again, very rapidly, the question is whether 54.1 and following can be used for cases that take place in administrative tribunals and whether those can be declared improper.
And the simple answer is no. Tribunal is defined in the Code of Civil Procedure, and that does not include an administrative court. That said, a procedure issued out of an administrative court, for instance, a motion for judicial review, might give rise to the application of 54.1, and indeed there are precedents where it has. So the answer is not before the administrative court, but yes, before the judicial court. Thank you.
With that, I'd like on all your behalfs to really thank Justice Kelly. We'll take a 15-minute break and we'll be back at 8 o'clock.
Mesdames et messieurs, si vous voulez prendre vos sièges, s'il vous plaît, on va reprendre. Mesdames et messieurs, si vous me permettez, on va reprendre la soirée. C'est à mon tour, à titre d'autre co-organisatrice de cette série, de vous souhaiter la bienvenue ce soir et de vous présenter avec grand plaisir mon collègue Frédéric Bachand. In true McGill bilingual style, I will present him in French, although he will be addressing you in English. Alors, Frédéric Bachand est professeur agrégé à la faculté où il enseigne dans les domaines des modes extrajudiciaires de résolution de différends, du droit judiciaire privé et de la preuve civile. Ses recherches, qui lui ont valu plusieurs récompenses majeures, portent sur l'arbitrage interne et international, et il s'intéresse plus particulièrement aux rapports qu'entretiennent tribunaux étatiques et tribunaux arbitraux. Il est également co-directeur du programme d'été en arbitrage de McGill. Monsieur Bachand détient des doctorats de l'Université Panthéon-Assas, Paris 2, et de l'Université de Montréal. Il a été clerc auprès du juge Gérard de la Forêt à la Cour suprême. Il est membre de nombreux organismes professionnels, dont le comité scientifique de la Revue de l'arbitrage, l'Institute for Transnational Arbitration et le groupe d'experts conseils sur l'arbitrage de différends de la Banque mondiale. Il est également correspondant national auprès de la Commission des Nations unies pour le droit commercial international. Monsieur Bachand agit également à titre de consultant, tant sur la scène locale que sur la scène internationale. Alors, je vous demande de vous joindre à moi pour souhaiter la bienvenue à Monsieur Bachand.
Merci infiniment, Véronique. Merci, Rosalie. Et félicitations à vous deux pour l'extraordinaire travail que vous faites dans le cadre de cette série. Juste à voir tout le monde qui vient, qui revient. C'est une preuve très tangible du grand succès de vos initiatives. Alors, and thank you very much. I'm truly delighted to be honored to be here tonight. And delighted also to talk about this upcoming new Code of Civil Procedure, the draft, the bill that was made public in September of last year, and which is currently being discussed, as was mentioned earlier, before the Commission des Institutions, Standing Committee of the National Assembly. The hearing started last week. So the draft bill it results from an effort that dates back from 1998, actually. That's when the Ministry of Justice here created a committee on civil justice reform, which ended up submitting a report 3 years later, in 2001. This committee was presided by Professor Denis Ferland of Laval University. You've probably heard about the Ferland report, which called for significant reforms to our civil justice system, starting with a fundamental change of the dominant culture of civil litigation, which to many people was thought to be and is still thought to be primarily responsible for what is commonly and rightly referred to as the crisis, unfortunately, in our civil justice system. So right after the Ferland report, several measures were adopted very quickly. You're familiar with the six-month time limit within which the pretrial phase must be concluded, proportionality, restrictions on examinations, on discovery, the oral defense. But the long-term plan was always to eventually come up with a brand new, rewritten, restructured Code of Civil Procedure, which would hopefully address efficiently the most significant causes of the widespread discontent towards our civil justice system. So we're here, and it's a very exciting development. It's a significant achievement. The draft bill has been tabled, although it's an achievement that is very frightening to all of us who teach civil procedure, because we know that at some point we'll have to really restructure our courses or change our courses. But that is not a relevant point. So what I want to focus on tonight is one aspect of the reform, so those parts of the reform which touch on private alternative dispute resolution processes, private ADR processes. And it makes perfect sense to think about ADR when we're thinking about civil justice reform, because the evidence of mediation and arbitration's potential to increase access to justice is most compelling. And I choose my words carefully here when I speak of ADR's potential to increase access to justice, because I think it would be a mistake to think that ADR is always desirable in all contexts and in every circumstances and so on. Mediation is problematic where there exists a significant imbalance of power or informational imbalance between the parties. And I can guarantee you that a party who arbitrates a $30,000 claim before a three-member arbitral tribunal will come out of the process thinking that those who think that arbitration is, you know, super cost-effective and so on are complete nuts. Because if you have a very small claim, you want to go with a one-member, a sole arbitrator, and certainly not a three-member panel. It will cost you a fortune. That said, the potential of ADR is clearly there, so the Department of Justice was conscious of that, and it was right to focus on this. And as it turns out, ADR is one of the areas that would be the most that would be most affected by the proposed changes. So what I propose to do tonight is to focus on these parts of the draft bill that touch on arbitration and mediation, and I essentially want to develop three basic points tonight and hopefully continue the discussion during question period. First of all, I want to underscore a philosophical paradigm shift that the draft bill operates, a paradigm shift regarding the relationship between private ADR processes and the public adjudicative system, the traditional court system. Secondly, we'll look briefly at the proposed mediation framework, and which I think is by and large solid. I think it's a good start. I think that they've done a pretty good job in Quebec to set the ground for what will probably turn out to be a pretty strong, pretty robust mediation framework. The last part of my talk will focus on the proposed arbitration law reform, and here, unfortunately, I will have to be much more critical, as I think that it does not even deserve a passing grade. And I say this with all due respect, and my colleague Fabien Gélinas and I, he also works in the area of arbitration, were so concerned when the draft bill came out that we actually got together, everybody at a quickly organized conference last fall. Practitioners and academics in Quebec were particularly interested in arbitration, just to raise the red flags and say we need to do something about this. And that is what got the ball rolling, and we ended up submitting a draft memorandum to the commission, which we had the privilege of presenting in person last week. And I'm delighted to say that it went pretty well, and we're fairly confident that the Minister of Justice will go back to the drawing board, at least with that aspect of the reform. And I'll try to help you understand why it is so problematic. All right, so let's start with this first idea of a fundamental paradigm shift. And I think to properly put in context the evolving conception of the public adjudicative system which underlies a draft bill, it's useful to do a bit of history, as this will help us understand how the draft bill can be seen as a logical evolution of a philosophical shift which actually started not too long ago, in the 1970s. That's when we started moving away from this idea which until then was so central to our conception of civil justice, the idea that public adjudication was the only truly legitimate dispute resolution method. That's the kind of idea that led, for instance, the Supreme Court of Canada in 1964 to rule that undertakings to arbitrate, arbitration clauses of the kind that we find in so many contracts today, is against public order. So in the same category as contracts facilitating bribes or contracts whereby one would sell an organ, these truly egregious contractual arrangements to which the law gave absolutely no effect. So private ADR processes were not outlawed per se, but the applicable legal framework rested on this idea that they were inherently problematic. They were thought to be of inferior quality, and they were also thought to sort of threaten or jeopardize the court's quasi-monopoly over justice. So things started moving at the end of the 1970s, but actually early 1980s insofar as Quebec is concerned, and so formal law and formal institutions started entering into a new era, the era of tolerance. And we can find evidence of this shift in cases like Zodiac, which essentially overturned the national gypsum decision of 20 years before, the Quebec arbitration reform of 1986. And essentially, what courts and legislatures started doing then is to abandon legal doctrines that rested on this idea that ADR, generally speaking, only offered an inferior kind of justice. Then starting in the late 1990s, as far as Quebec is concerned, we started moving towards an era where ADR was not merely tolerated, but actually positively encouraged. So courts, for instance, the Court of Appeal in Laurentienne Vie in 2000, which clearly said that the right to arbitrate was a fundamental right. Desputo, the Supreme Court of Canada, in the Caillou case that you may recall, which rendered a very pro-arbitration decision restricting greatly public order-based limits on party autonomy and the autonomy of the arbitral process. Then Dell Computer in 2007, which extended the pro-ADR policy in a particularly sensitive area, consumer transactions, and judges had no problem with the proposition that ADR and private justice were also suited to these, you know, relationships of private law, which we consider to be sensitive because they always involve an inherent imbalance of power between the parties. Judicial mediation programs, of course, which were adopted, again, provide compelling evidence of this shift, as well as the evolving ethical duties of lawyers. The Canadian Bar Association's Code of Conduct was amended a few years ago to include provisions that clearly require lawyers to seriously consider ADR for every single case and to properly inform their clients on with respect to the available ADR options. So what happens with the draft bill, which I find so interesting? Well, it seems that we're pushing this pro-ADR movement one step further. And I see this from provisions which essentially rest on the idea that public adjudication from now on should be viewed as the subsidiary, the when all else has failed means of resolving civil and commercial disputes. It jumps at you when you start reading the proposed Code of Civil Procedure. You find in, this is just an excerpt of the table of contents, it starts logically with sections setting out general principles of civil procedure. The general principles regarding ADR come before the general principles regarding public adjudication. This is remarkable. The code actually starts with seven provisions which deal only with private justice, and it's only after that you find what you would expect, the general principles of civil litigation. Look at Article 2, Paragraph 1. Parties will now have, it's explicit, parties will now have a duty to consider mediation, negotiation, and arbitration before contemplating bringing their disputes to court. So it's incredible. It's very striking to see law formally recognize and even support this idea of public adjudication becoming something subsidiary, something that citizens should turn to when all other options have been exhausted, and I'm sure that this will have significant consequences, not only in legal practice, but also in legal education. We need to take act of this. It's a reality. Most experienced litigators are already aware of this, but to see formal law and legal institutions clearly embrace this idea and even support it is a remarkable development, and to my knowledge, no other jurisdiction has gone as far as what the minister proposes to do here. Okay, that said, second point, let's look at the proposed mediation framework. First of all, it's an exciting development because Quebec doesn't have and never had a legislative framework dealing with private mediation. This will be a first, and we can start by pointing out that we're a little late in this respect, in the sense that there is a global movement whereby jurisdictions in both common law tradition and civil law, from the civil law tradition, have adopted mediation laws in the past decade, and it's somewhat paradoxical because we've been in many ways pioneers and innovators in the field of mediation, particularly judicial mediation. Now, so the draft bill would fix that and, you know, comprehensively regulate private mediation. And you may be asking yourself now, well, what's the point in regulating private mediation? It's a non-adjudicative, very flexible process. It's easier to understand why we need rules for arbitration, but do we really need rules with respect to mediation? Unlike, I mean, in arbitration, the parties lose control over the outcome, so you want to make sure that, you know, natural justice is complied with. You want some sort of basic rules of evidence to make sure that the process will be fair. In mediation, it's harder to see the argument for regulation. But essentially, comparative analysis shows that most jurisdictions now accept the basic idea that some form of regulation is appropriate, especially with respect to confidentiality and privilege, which is sort of universally accepted to be an area where regulation is important, as well as provisions regarding the quality or integrity of the mediation process. And we'll look at in more detail in a second at the kinds of rules that could that have been adopted or proposed by the ministry. So those are the two most important points. You will also find in some mediation laws provisions giving full effect to undertakings to mediate, so mediation clauses, provisions regarding the effect of mediated settlements, of prescription, very little on the mediation procedure itself. There's a developing consensus that we don't really need a lot of procedural rules with respect to how mediation develops per se. All right, so let's look at the proposed framework and some of the highlights which I would like to bring to your attention. I start with three very quick points because I don't think there's much to say here. We find in the draft bill provisions on impartiality and also disclosure standards, so a basic requirement of impartiality and an obligation on the mediator to disclose potential conflicts of interest and so on. Totally expected. They've done a very good job here. I think that they've canvassed all the issues, and those are satisfactory provisions. Clear articulation of the parties' good faith obligation in the mediation process. So there are absolutely no traces of the common law's traditional reluctance to, you know, effectively recognize binding obligations to negotiate in good faith. This is totally the civil law influence here which underlies these provisions. And two thumbs up as far as I'm concerned. I think there's no reason why we wouldn't want this articulated clearly in a mediation framework. Confidentiality and privilege is also addressed in two different provisions of the draft bill, confidentiality obligations, privilege being sort of the counterpart, the related concept, but which operates at an evidentiary level to render inadmissible evidence relating to the mediation process. We could come back on question period about how they did it, because I think that we were a bit too enthusiastic about mediation privilege and pushed it too far. There should be exceptions there that I don't see, but those are fairly trivial and technical points. What I want to spend a bit more time on are three aspects of the draft bill, which I find particularly noteworthy because they touch on issues that we don't find or don't see addressed usually in modern arbitration laws. First of all, second paragraph of Article 611, we find what I call an interesting take on the professionalization debate. Here's what the provision basically holds. It holds that the part of the mediation privilege that essentially says that the mediator cannot be compelled to testify on what went on during the mediation in subsequent judicial or arbitral proceedings only applies to mediators who have received training from an institution that was recognized by the Minister of Justice, which means that a mediator who was not officially accredited could be compelled in later and subsequent adjudicative proceedings to provide evidence on what went on. And this is very interesting. There's an ongoing worldwide debate about whether mediation should be organized into a profession. There's a big argument against, which essentially asserts that mediation would lose its flexibility. The argument for is, of course, quality control, protection of the public, the usual arguments in favor of professionalization. So here it's interesting. I mean, it's very innovative. The department doesn't go so far as to say, you know, mediators should be organized into a profession, but it's creating what I think will be pretty strong incentive for parties in practice to favor mediators who have been officially accredited. So, very interesting provision here. Second point, mediation's darker side acknowledged and taken fairly seriously. I briefly mentioned at the outset that mediation can be problematic in situations of informational or power imbalance. With respect to power imbalance, when you're in mediation, you don't have the protection of rules of protective public order that a judge would apply when you're a consumer or an insured against insurance company and so on. You don't have that. With respect to the informational imbalance, when you go into mediation, you don't have the discovery process, which in the public adjudicative system can be an opportunity for a weaker, more vulnerable party to some extent to redress an informational imbalance. So these problems are actually acknowledged and taken very seriously in the draft bill. We find, for instance, at Article 2, Paragraph 1, a provision which explicitly sets out transparency obligations. Parties, as part of their good faith duty, would have an obligation to share all relevant information with the other party. So the idea, of course, is to redress the informational imbalance, but this takes it quite far. You don't normally see this in modern arbitration laws. Mediators are required to react strongly when faced with situation of potential prejudice or serious inequality that they perceive in the mediation process. They have to raise the problems with the parties, and they have to take necessary measures to correct the problems. This is actually quite remarkable as well. The draft bill clearly rejects the idea that mediators should remain passive when confronted with injustice on the ground, and this is you know, how the theory goes. Mediators shouldn't care about that because that's the judge's role, first of all, and mediators have to remain impartial in front of the party. So this is what justifies the model of the very passive mediator. I've never been convinced that it was appropriate, so I can only applaud the Departments of Justice courage, I would say, in reconceiving the role of the mediator. Mediators' immunity. We're extending immunity to mediators, and this is actually quite surprising. It's a very controversial topic. Many observers find no valid reason to extend immunity to mediators. It's easy to see why arbitrators should have immunity. They're adjudicators, and like judges, you want to preserve their liberty of judgment, and immunity is an important part of that, like, you know, independence and obligations of impartiality and so on. But we don't extend immunity to doctors and nurses and other professionals, so what's the justification for providing immunity to mediators? Big question mark. I don't think that there is a compelling one. We could talk about it later. But here Quebec clearly is moving away from a growing international consensus, I would say, that sort of stays away from providing private mediators with any form of immunity. Two things that are not in the proposed framework and that maybe should be there. First of all, nothing on mandatory mediation. So unlike Ontario, unlike Saskatchewan, we are not contemplating at this point introducing in the pretrial phase a mandatory mediation step. This raises interesting questions as to whether from a policy perspective it would be a good idea. I think it would be. If you want to talk about it in Q&A, I'd be glad to share my thoughts with you. But essentially, I think that to accelerate a cultural change leading to the emergence of a sophisticated ADR culture, mandatory mediation is a pretty good tool that we may want to consider a bit more seriously. The other thing I would like to see in the draft bill are cost rules designed to incentivize the parties vis-à-vis mediation in order to give some teeth to the party's good faith obligation, the party's obligation in Article 2, Paragraph 1, to seriously consider ADR before going to courts. And here I'm shamelessly stealing ideas from the English Court of Appeal, which has been particularly assertive in using the law of costs, to incentivize the parties vis-à-vis mediation. The first case, Halsey, is very interesting. It's a case that where essentially the court held that adverse cost orders could be made against a party who unreasonably turned down an offer to mediate. Pretty interesting. This could totally be used under the current framework here. Judges have enough discretion in the law of costs to make such orders. Leicester Circuit, the second case, situation where a party had agreed to undertake a mediation and at the 11th hour pulled out in bad faith for no valid reason, and the Court of Appeal in that case slapped it with an adverse cost order, which was completely justified, in my humble opinion. Okay, quickly, let's look at the proposed arbitration framework, and I start with a brief mise en contexte about where we are now, because we, unlike mediation, we have, of course, a comprehensive arbitration framework that was adopted, put in place in 1986, follows very closely international texts, international standards. That was an important part of the reform in 1986. We have a monist regime in the sense that it applies equally to international and domestic arbitration. Unlike in some jurisdiction, we haven't separated the two completely. Though not perfect, it's a pretty solid framework. It works well, especially after clarifications and support offered by the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal over the past, I would say, 12 or 15 years. And the arbitration community, so our little group of practitioners and academics who are particularly interested in arbitration, our group was not expecting anything more than a few, you know, fixes here and there to an already very satisfactory framework. So when we saw what was in the draft bill, we all went a bit, we were very surprised, to say the least. Nobody was consulted. None of the usual suspects in the arbitration field were consulted. The main problem we had, and this was our main message to the minister last week, they are rewriting and restructuring the entire chapter on arbitration for absolutely no valid reason. And this will inevitably inject some uncertainty, some unpredictability in the law. And why are we so troubled by that? Well, simply because arbitration is one of those fields where certainty and predictability matter greatly. It's an essential condition of a high-quality arbitration framework that the law be predictable, stable, easily accessible. The minute that you redraft, rewrite, restructure provisions, is necessarily you're throwing out the window years of courts, you know, contribution, jurisprudence that clarifies, that fills the gaps, and so on. And the worst part is that there's absolutely no valid reason to do this. Restructuring and rewriting would not serve any valid purpose as far as we are concerned, would not address a current and live problem. So we had a major problem with the form and just almost throwing in the wastebasket a reform that was undertaken 25 years ago. A few substantive provisions that we also did not like at all. I will speak briefly to the one that we found to be most troubling. Is actually a series of provisions that would allow judges to annul or to refuse to homologate arbitration awards on the ground, an arbitration award on the ground that giving effect to that award would bring the administration of justice into disrepute. Now, let me be clear about why I'm so troubled by this provision. I'm not saying that judges should rubber stamp arbitration awards even when they're completely outrageous because they've been rendered by a corrupt arbitrator or because the solution arrived at by the arbitrator on the merits makes no sense and is fundamentally at odds with our basic conceptions of morality and justice. The point, simply put, is that judges already have all the tools they need to deal with those particularly problematic arbitration awards. On the one of the basic ideas on which modern arbitration law rests is this, and it's an idea on which pretty much everybody agrees today, is the idea that judicial review of arbitration awards is only legitimate if it is limited to one of three issues: jurisdiction, procedure, or public order. You will not find one arbitration law among all of those adopted throughout the world in the past 30 years that has something similar to what the minister is proposing here. And the reason is simple. The internationally accepted grounds of review suffice to deal with truly problematic arbitration awards. And another very relevant point, which is specific to awards rendered in international cases, is that allowing judges to go beyond those three internationally accepted bases of review would clearly place Canada in breach of its international obligations because it conflicts with the 1958 New York Convention, which is now in force in 146 countries, which regulates the international arbitration process, and that was it's a treaty that was unfortunately overlooked in Quebec when they prepared the draft bill, but I think that they got the point, which we hammered last week when we spoke with them. So another few things that I'm not going to talk about in detail, but 940.3, if you know a little bit about arbitration law, it doesn't appear in the draft bill. So the rule which is actually set out now at Article 940.3, it's a very important rule to sort of regulate the relationship between judges and arbitral tribunals, is not reproduced and discarded in the draft bill for no valid reason, and so on. So we were very critical, but at the same time, there were several proposed substantive changes that we found to be very interesting, and I'm going to highlight a few of them before you, just to draw your attention to what will probably come, because everybody's expecting these proposals to be adopted. First of all, a clear affirmation of the confidential nature of arbitration and confidentiality obligations that attach to the, or that are applicable to the participants. This was until a few months ago an unclear question under Quebec law. And the Court of Appeal said that there was no inherent obligation of confidentiality. So the opposite solution is adopted here. Clear codification of the rules regarding immunity of arbitrators. That's all great. Provides stability and predictability. This is an interesting provision when we think about cost efficiency. This should have been done long ago. The default number of arbitrators right now is 3. Not a good idea. We would move to 1 for domestic cases, and our proposal was to say it should even be 1 for international cases for that matter. And other very technical changes on what we call negative jurisdictional review. I'm not going to bore you with that, but if you like arbitration and follow it closely, you may know what I'm talking about. And also a robust overhaul and necessary overhaul of the rules regarding provisional and conservatory measures adopted in by arbitral tribunals or by judges in support of arbitral proceedings. I end with a few observations of a socioeconomic nature from a socioeconomic perspective. Why does it matter so much that we have a high-quality arbitration framework? Well, first of all, it matters because the availability of an efficient commercial arbitration system fosters economic development. That is key, and there's lots of economic studies that have shown this. This is why the World Bank is so active in the field of ADR in developing countries. But the basic point is that allowing businesses to have access to a faster and cheaper means of resolving those disputes that they are unable to settle on their own, to settle amicably, promotes the rule of law, and in commercial dealings, and also lowers the costs of doing business. So it's good for all businesses, including the PME, small and medium-sized enterprises. We're not only talking about international arbitration here. But let's end with a point on international arbitration. Quebec has an incredible potential to become a world-class arbitration forum. A forum for resolving international disputes by means of arbitration. We're bilingual, we're bijural, we're accessible geographically from Europe, from the U.S., and so on. The low cost of living matters as well. You come here, your hotels won't cost you what it costs in New York and London, and so on. We have a geopolitical neutrality, which is we're good international citizens, and that matters when, you know, a company from Alabama and Germany is figuring out where to legally locate their arbitral proceedings. We, thanks to, you know, the efforts like of people like Yves Fortier, Marc Lalonde, Armand de Métral, Alain Pruginaire, Nabil Antaki, the pioneers of arbitration in Quebec, we have developed a real and precious reputation of excellence in the field. And of course, we have great restaurants and nightlife, which is always the bottom line at the end when you're picking a seat of arbitration. The point is that we've been saying this for 25 years. Quebec could really be a bit like Switzerland or Stockholm, sort of a, you know, 3-star in the Michelin guide of international arbitration forums. The point is that we will never get there if we don't have a top quality arbitration law. And so it matters as well from an economic development perspective, from those two angles. And this is why we shouldn't only, and this it was also an important message that we tried to send to the Commission last week. We were speaking to politicians and they have their constituencies and so on. The point was trying to highlight that this is not merely technical stuff that only is of interest to people involved in the field, but there is a socio-economic issue behind that. On this note, I'm 2.5 minutes late. I apologize, Madame la Présidente, and I thank you very much for coming in your attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Frédéric. I think you won't be surprised to learn that my colleague has just returned from a sabbatical leave, and that, I think, goes some way to explain the very energetic and, I dare say, passionate presentation. So we have time for some questions that I will do my best to convey to the other rooms. Sir, please.
Could you give us some of the details of the World
Trust Bank? I was in Singapore, I'm sorry. I missed out on everything last year.
Yes, please.
So the question is, how could we use a law of cost to incentivize the parties without breaching confidentiality? Well, it's a good question. The way that it is, it will be addressed in the cases where, because we need to distinguish a few things. In those two cases, I don't think a confidentiality problem actually arose, because HALSEA is a situation where there never was a mediation. The party unreasonably turned down an offer to mediate, so they never got to the point where information, sensitive information, was generated in a mediation. And in the second case, same thing. They pulled out after having agreed to mediate. So just to illustrate that these rules can be useful even in situations where there hasn't been any mediation. So what happens if there is a mediation? One of the party doesn't mediate in good faith. And then an allegation is made at the end of the process that there was a breach of the good faith obligation. And you want to bring that up before a judge, but the judge has been hearing the case, deciding the case, and you don't want that judge to acquire mediation, sensitive mediation information. I mean, there is a tension between, you know, guaranteeing the integrity of the process and confidentiality on the other hand. The pragmatic way to deal with this is to raise the question and deal with the cost separately after the case has been decided on the merits by the judge at first instance. And then if we're willing to, you know, breach or open a breach on the principle of confidentiality in order to give some teeth to the obligation to mediate in good faith, then have that debate. But once the dispute has been adjudicated by the judge in a separate hearing regarding costs, and then without eliminating all problems, you reduce the risks of sensitive information, becoming known to the judge in a way that could negatively affect that the judge's reasoning.
Thank you.
course. Well, it's, I mean, this is something that, so essentially the question relates to the extent to which litigants without the means of the Bombardier and so on and the big companies can actually afford mediation, and whether mediation and arbitration could be too costly or not sufficiently cost effective for these parties. That certainly is a valid consideration when we're thinking about mandatory processes like mandatory mediation or quasi-mandatory arbitration of the kind that we find in consumer relations, where you and I don't, you know, we consent to these arbitration clauses in consumer contracts, which have been invalidated now for exactly those reasons, for very good reasons. But your comment highlights underscores the point I was making earlier, that ADR is not appropriate for every single circumstances. It's not appropriate in every context. Whether we have taken that sufficiently to consideration in Quebec, I would say yes with respect to arbitration. I think the consumer arbitration debate that took place a few years ago showed that the legislator was sensitive to that. The legislator didn't like the overly pro-arbitration decisions which were made by courts in the consumer context, and I think there were some very valid reasons to be a bit more careful about using arbitration in the consumer context. With respect to mediation, it's coming now. We didn't have a comprehensive framework with respect to private mediation, so these problems of imbalance that could occur and that could materialize in mediation proceedings were left unregulated for now. We've been focusing in Quebec on judicial mediation for the past 10 years. That has been the focus of the reforms. But you're absolutely right to raise this point. And I think this is a step in the right direction with, you know, adopting this model where we conceive the role of the mediator as not being completely passive, but as having to care about justice. I think sends the right message, because we don't want mediation to only bring peace. We want mediation to bring peace and justice as well. And that also means taking into consideration these kinds of imbalance issues, certainly. Question is, will arbitration be extended to family law? Right now, family law is completely off limits as far as arbitration is concerned. Article 2639 of the Code of Civil Code says that. This is being left untouched in the draft bill. So I haven't seen anything that suggests that Quebec would reconsider what we call the inarbitrability of family law dispute and move towards a model similar to what they've done in Ontario, which is to allow family arbitration, but regulating it very heavily in order to address concerns such as those that were raised that are similar to the ones that were raised. So there will be none extended for nothing that I've seen, and if the submissions, the written submissions that were filed with the commission that I saw, nobody is favorable to that or has raised this.
We have time for one last question, if there is one. Yes.
Oh, no, no, no. The corrupt arbitrator, it falls. Oh, sorry. The question, sorry. Why do I have a problem with extending immunity to mediators while at the same time extending it to the corrupt arbitrator? So, second part of the... I understand. But it gives me the opportunity to highlight that arbitral immunity is not absolute. Even judicial immunity is not absolute. You can actually hold a judge civilly liable in Canada if you can prove two things, bad faith and excessive jurisdiction. It's pretty hard to establish. In arbitration, it would only be bad faith, la faute lourde intentionnelle, and so on. And we need that. We want, of course, not to treat immunity in absolute terms. I'll put the question to you. What is the rationale for extending immunity to mediators? once we understand that they're not adjudicators, they don't decide cases in a final and binding manner in the way that, that judges do, they're professionals like all other professionals, like lawyers, like doctors, like nurses, and so on. And we don't think that doctors and nurses are particularly special or important enough to deserve to be shielded from civil liability. So the question is, why would we do this for mediators? And what you see in the literature are arguments such as, well, it's important because we want that profession to be attractive, because we want to generate a pool of mediators, which I'm like, this is the worst justification to extend immunity. As far as I'm concerned, I'm like, no, I'm not convinced. But this is, you know, the kinds of things that you see. What Americans will do more readily is to extend immunity to judicial officials, officials of the courthouse who are not judges, but who provide mediation services, public mediation services. Because, you know, instead of providing public mediation services through judges like we've done here, in other jurisdictions, what they do is that they actually have full-time dispute resolution professionals at the courthouse who are, you know, full-time mediators and trained to be mediators. And judges do the judging and the mediators do the mediating. And because they're public officials and they're considered to be sufficiently part of the court system, some immunity is exempted to them. But even in that case, the argument is not completely compelling. But in a purely private setting, help me find a compelling justification. I don't see it. I think that they should be, get insurance like other professionals and behave. I mean, no. Yeah, it only it. Yeah. That's a very good point. I mean, issues of liability in a model like this one, where you're expecting the mediator to be more active, are harder. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much to our wonderful speakers, and we'll see you at our next presentation on February 28th. Good night.